Well, I know David would like me to reminisce some more about our times together at Princeton. We only wrote 3 papers together, and they all had more or less the same title. It was a tremendously exciting time, and many things came together fortuitously. So, of course, there was the anomaly cancellation of Green and Schwartz in the summer of 84. And David had been, I think, had arranged to teach a special topics course that fall. And my memory was he wasn't quite sure what he was going to teach, but it was became clear that it should be a course on string theory. And it's really hard for me to remember how little was understood at the time. I remember the first few lectures he gave, it was all pictures. There were no formulae. Of course, Emil Martinek had come to Princeton as a new postdoc, and not many people knew about string theory at that time, of course. There were a few from the old days, but Emil was one of the young people who had actually learned string theory in graduate school, and he came to Princeton and knew about some very important work of Goddard and Olive. And of course, Ryan Rome was there, and was also, as a graduate student, working on string theory before the first revolution, because Ed Witten thought that string theory was important and had given Ryan some problems to work on. So I was the one who knew nothing about string theory, but I think in what we did, ignorance helped to a certain degree. And so it was a very exciting time. I remember after many wild ideas and discussions and false starts, one morning when Emil Martinek wrote down on the blackboard the light cone degrees of freedom of the heterotic string, just a few fields. And by lunch, we couldn't quite see what was wrong with it, but thought if we calmer heads prevailed, we got some food into us, that we would figure out what was wrong with it. But it didn't fall apart, and it took us a couple weeks to find a factor of 2. But once we found the factor of 2, everything else just followed. And the feeling that many of us have that string theory is something that we discover rather than invent, I think was, I never felt that more strongly than with the heterotic string. You start with just a few fields and everything else just followed one piece after the other. So once we knew that it made sense, there was a competition. The competition was to calculate a 4-point tree amplitude. And believe me, David won that one hands down. One thing that David said to me at that time I really sort of cherish and remember. He said, you know, you are just too young to know how good things are right now. The opportunity to be involved in something that you know is of fundamental importance, where you're really on top of the world, and you know that everybody else is paying attention to what you're doing, is something that you get very few times in your career. David more than most of us, of course. But he was really right.
It was a very special time, and I was too young to really understand how special it was. So, David, happy birthday. I hope that you at least have many more times like that. Now, I should apologize to those of you in the audience who were at the Strings 2001 meeting, because other than the first slide, this is pretty much the same talk that I gave there. I know a lot of you weren't, so I hope it's not too boring. David was, but I think, David, at your age, hearing things twice probably helps. So string theory has 2 kinds of solitons. It has what are called Nivens-Schwartz fibrains, although Nivens-Schwartz didn't really have much to do with it, right? But anyway, these were discovered by Andy Strominger, and Kurt Callan and Andy and I worked out a number of their properties. And they have a mass that scales like 1 over the closed string coupling squared, and therefore can be thought of as solitons of closed string theory. Whereas D-brains, courtesy of Joel Polchinski, have a mass that scales like 1 over the closed string coupling, but that is 1 over the open string coupling squared. And so it might make sense to think of them as solitons of open string theory. And this sort of idea fits in nicely with discussions that Sen proposed starting a few years ago involving condensation of open string tachyons. And so there's been quite an industry trying to understand tachyon condensation in open strings and whether we can think of D-brains as solitons in open string theory. So I'm not going to be saying anything that's terribly new, but I am going to be talking about a particular point of view on this problem which I and other people have been involved in for about a year, and I think it's now reached a fairly satisfactory state, so I think it's a good point to sort of summarize where we are. There are undoubtedly many new things to be done, but we have reached a certain level of understanding in one way of thinking about this problem. So the main points that I'm going to discuss are, first of all, just in general, talking about solitons and non-commutative theory, I'm going to show that a number of these solutions can be constructed in a unified way. I'm going to apply these techniques to unstable D-brain systems in the presence of a non-zero B field and show that this leads to a detailed description of lower dimensional D-brains as non-commutative solitons, as we hope to find. And then if I have time, I'll talk a little bit about some more mathematical work that involves trying to understand how one should describe D-brain charge in this framework, and that involves things like the K-theory of C-star algebras. So, just a very quick outline then. I'll remind you briefly about what non-commutative geometry is and what non-commutative field theory is. I'll explain a technique that unifies various solutions that have been found, a solution-generating transformation. I'll apply that to tachyon condensation and string theory, and then maybe do a little bit of K-theory. So many people have contributed to this, and a rather partial list of references is given here. I was particularly motivated to start thinking about these problems by the work of Sen and Zwieback on tachyon condensation that was presented at the Millennium Conference in Caltech, and then the paper by Gopakumar, Manwala, and Strominger showing that there were very simple solitons in non-commutative theory. And many other people have worked on this. In particular, in this case, David and I and, collaborators have to some degree been competitors. He and Nekrasov have written several important papers that overlap with some of what I'm going to talk about. The underlying papers that I've done in collaboration with Krauss, Larson, Martinek, and then Greg Moore are what I will be discussing. And of course, this all builds on the work on understanding non-commutative geometry and field theory and string theory due to many people, but in particular, Schomerus and Seiberg and Witten. And of course, that itself builds on earlier work on open string theory and background fields. So one way of understanding the origin of non-commutative geometry is just by thinking about quantum mechanics. And it really goes back, in large part, to the work of Weil, and can be found in his nice book on group theory and quantum mechanics. So the Heisenberg commutation relations can be thought of the commutation relations of a Lie algebra. And if you have a Lie algebra, then you should define a group element by exponentiation. And then if you look at the product of group elements, you find that you get an abelian group structure, but with a phase that shows that you have a projective representation of the abelian group of translations in phase space generated by the coordinate and momentum operators. Now, there's a transform called the Weil transform, which is a map between classical dynamical variables on phase space and quantum mechanical operators. And it views operators as linear combinations of these Weil-Heisenberg group elements. And if this function here is the Fourier transform of a function on phase space, then in the limit that h bar goes to 0, this is simply the ordinary function. But for finite h bar, it's an operator and has non-trivial properties. And you can invert this map to get a function on phase space given an operator. And this formula is also referred to as Weil ordering because given a classical function, it tells you how to construct a quantum mechanical operator with a definite ordering prescription. Now, this defines a non-commutative geometry on R2, phase space, by giving you a non-commutative deformation of the product of functions. So in particular, the product of two operators, which are Weil transforms of functions f and g, is the Weil transform of the function f star g, where the star product is given by this, this exponential. And if you expand that out, that well, the first leading term of that is theta goes to 0, just the ordinary product of functions. And so this defines a non-commutative algebra of functions on R2, and therefore a kind of non-commutative geometry in the sense that a commutative algebra of functions defines ordinary geometry. Now, in non-commutative geometry, it's also natural to introduce derivatives, which was also done by Weil. by noting that the Weyl transform of the derivative of a function with the specter coordinate is the commutator with the momentum operator, and similarly for the derivative with respect to the momentum derivative of the function. Or more generally, if we're not working in R2, but in R2n with a symplectic form theta, then we can write the derivative operator as the inverse of theta times the adjoint action of xi, where xi is the coordinate on the non-commutative space. Now, it's useful to distinguish various classes of functions by the properties of their Weyl transforms, or vice versa. So if we have some function on phase space that obeys this bound, classified by some integer m, then when m is less than or equal to 0, so the functions, for example, at infinity can at worst approach a constant, then the Weyl transforms of those are bounded operators. Whereas if m is less than 0, so that the functions vanish at infinity, the Weyl transforms are compact operators. And those form an ideal in the algebra of bounded operators on Hilbert space. So we can define non-commutative field theories in a variety of ways. We can think about fields on this non-commutative R2n with multiplied using the star product. Using the Weyl transform, we can also view that as a field theory where the fields are operators on Hilbert space, or as in matrix theory, we can think of those operators on Hilbert space as being an n goes to infinity limit of n by n matrices. Now, it's also natural, and occurs in D-brain physics, to introduce gauge fields, to introduce non-commutative gauge field theories. And the gauge fields naturally gauge the gauge group of unitary transformations on Hilbert space. So if phi transforms like this in the adjoint representation, one can define a covariant derivative, which transforms covariantly. And in complex coordinates on R2, just to make things simple, we can write the derivative in terms of a combination of a quantity A bar, which is related to the complex fields up to a rescaling, plus the gauge field. And we can call that combination of A bar plus I theta to the 1/2 A, C. And then the field strength components take this simple form in terms of a commutator of C. Now, given that, we can see that there's a way to construct non-trivial solutions starting from rather trivial solutions. And the argument goes as follows. Let's imagine that we have an action for a non-commutative field theory depending on some scalar fields and some gauge fields, which has UH gauge symmetry, that is, unitary transformations on Hilbert space. So the equations of motion will transform covariantly as long as there's no term linear on the fields in the action. A restriction which we'll have to make and which also appeared in the original work of GMS. So if there's no linear term, then the equations of motion will transform covariantly. But in showing that they transform covariantly, we actually only need to use the fact that u bar u is equal to 1, where u bar is the Hermitian adjoint of the operator u, because we only need to get rid of the u bar u in strings of operators. Now, in a finite dimensional Hilbert space, u bar u being equal to 1 would imply that u bar is equal to 1, but this is not true in infinite dimensions. So if we have a transformation where u bar u is equal to 1, but u bar is not equal to 1, that will take a solution to another solution, because the equations of motion transform covariantly, but it will not be an equivalent solution, because if u bar is not equal to 1, then transformations by that u are not gauge symmetries, because the gauge symmetries are unitary transformations, and this would not be unitary. Now, what are such beasts? Well, if u bar is equal to 1, if u bar u is equal to 1, then if we square u bar, we get u bar back, so that tells us that u bar is a projection operator. Now, things where u bar u is equal to 1 are called isometries, for the obvious reason that if you transform states in Hilbert space, the inner product or the metric is preserved. So the things that will generate new solutions that are not gauge equivalent to the starting point are isometries that are not unitary. It's just a fancy way of saying that u bar u is 1 and u bar is not. So non-unitary isometries will generate gauge inequivalent solutions to the equations of motion of a non-commutative gauge theory. A canonical example of such a non-unitary isometry is the shift operator, or a power of the shift operator. So if n, running from 0 to infinity, labels a basis for a separable Hilbert space, then the operator that shifts n up by 1 obeys s bar s is equal to 1, and similarly for any power of s bar. But s times s bar is equal to 1 minus a projection operator onto the lowest state, and s to the n, s bar to the n is 1 minus a projection operator onto the first n states. So this shift operator, which is not quite the creation operator, but rescaled, is an example of a non-unitary isometry. So we can use that example to find solutions in non-commutative field theories. And let me give you an example of how this works. So let's start in 2 plus 1 dimensions. You can think of x1 and x2 as the coordinates on phase space in quantum mechanics, or here just as non-commutative coordinates on R2. And let's take a fairly simple action that has a standard gauge field action, a kinetic action for some scalar fields, and then a potential. And if we look at static solutions, I'm not going to put in non-commutivity in the time direction, but only in the space-space direction, then in the operator language, where we view fields as operators on Hilbert space, the action is 2 pi theta times a trace on Hilbert space of this quantity, where I've now taken the gauge fields, dropped time derivatives, and rewritten the gauge fields in terms of this quantity C. And with an example of unstable D brains in mind, let's imagine that we choose the potential so that there is a vacuum at phi equals phi star, and then some other stationary point here at the origin. And in this theory, there is a vacuum where phi is phi star constant, and the gauge field is equal to 0, so that C is equal to A bar. The gauge field A is simply equal to 0. And, well, that's the vacuum of this particular theory. Now, if we act with one of these non-unitary isometries, we are guaranteed that we will generate a new solution because the equations of motion transform covariantly. So if we act with U is equal to the nth power of the shift operator, we generate a scalar field, which is phi star times 1 minus a projection operator onto the first n states. And we get a gauge field, which is a sort of almost gauge transform of the vacuum gauge field. Now, this solution in 2 plus 1 dimensions has some flux. You can compute the flux in the gauge field. It's 1 over theta times a rank n projection operator. And it has some non-zero energy, which depends on a 1 over theta squared term coming from the gauge field energy, and then a term proportional to the value of the potential at minus phi star. Now, this solution that we've generated using this idea of a solution-generating transformation reduces to various solutions that people have studied before. So if we get rid of the potential term, or just set phi star equal to 0, then this is the fluxon solution that various people, including David, have looked at. If we drop the gauge fields instead, then this reduces to the soliton solution that Gopakumar, Manuel, and Strominger originally looked at, where you have scalar fields proportional to projection operators. You can easily extend all of this to R2n. The energy diverges as theta goes to 0, which is in accordance with Dirac's theorem, since there aren't supposed to be finite energy solutions in higher dimensions. And this solution, you can show by working out the Weyl transform of this operator, is a localized solution. That is, the function on phase space is exponentially localized around some point. And so this does represent a well-localized soliton solution that has a non-zero field, Higgs field, and a non-zero gauge field. So we start from the vacuum, and using this simple idea, we're able to generate non-trivial solutions that are related to other solutions that have been studied previously, but it gives us a somewhat more unified point of view in telling us how to construct them. Also, the analysis that GMS did involved going to large theta, where the fields were represented by projection operators, and here we've shown that they're represented by projection operators at finite theta. Now, we can generalize this idea to vortex solutions in a theory that has a complex scalar field, or an operator language where the operator is not self-adjoint. And in that case, if you have a complex rather than a real field, it's natural to find a gauge symmetry which is a non-commutative U1 times U1, or in other words, unitary transformations on Hilbert space times unitary transformations on Hilbert space that act independently from the left and the right. And an example, again, designed with unstable D-brain systems in mind, is a theory that has two gauge fields. I'll call them A plus and A minus. Kinetic terms for the gauge fields, covariant terms for the scalar field, and then a potential which we'll take to be some kind of a Mexican hat potential with a ring of minima at phi bar equal to 1. So this theory has a gauge symmetry, which is UH times UH. You can make independent unitary transformations acting on the left and right of phi. And then the two gauge fields, or rather the quantities C minus and C plus related to them, transform covariantly under those two sets of gauge transformations. And now, since you have UH times UH, you can play this game twice in each component and look at non-unitary isometries that in each Hilbert space. So we could take U to be an nth power and V to be the mth power of a shift operator. And starting from a vacuum where phi is just equal to 1 and the gauge field is equal to 0, this generates a solution where phi is s to the m times s bar to the n, and the gauge fields are again these sort of almost gauge transforms of the vacuum configuration. If you study what this means in a little more detail, you can see that the non-commutative U1 times U1 symmetry has been broken down to U1. And you can think of this as representing n vortices and m anti-vortices of the broken U1 by computing the gauge field and seeing that that has the correct flux. So this shows that you can generate non-commutative solitons both in theories with real and complex scalar fields coupled to gauge fields, starting just from the vacuum configuration and acting with these non-unitary isometries. Now, it's fairly straightforward to apply these ideas to the kind of non-commutative field theories which arise in string theory when you have an unstable D-brain system in the presence of a B-field. And this, of course, is a long story, which I'm just going to summarize in one transparency. Either you know it or you don't, and if you don't, you're certainly not going to learn it from me. So in a convention discussed in Seiberg and Witten and elaborated further by Nadi in another paper, there's a certain two-form called phi, which is sort of up to you to choose. And there's a particular choice of it where it's equal to minus the B field. And you can then construct the non-commutative theory where the open string parameters are a non-commutivity parameter, which is 1 over B, an open string metric, which is related to the closed string metric little g in this way, and an open string coupling capital GS, which is related to the closed string coupling little gs, and the B field and the metric by that formula. So that's the result of some hard work. But we can use that then to try to study various systems in string theory where we have non-commutative field theories arising as a limit of string theory. And one of the simplest examples is to start with an unstable D25 brain in the bosonic string. And that theory has a tachyon. And from a variety of different points of view, we believe that there's a potential which has an unstable maximum here, which represents the D25 brain, and then a stable minimum, which represents the annihilation of the unstable D25 brain to the closed string vacuum. So we can try to turn on various B fields and to construct an effective action for the lightest fields on this unstable D brain, namely the gauge field and the tachyon, and see what kinds of solutions we find if we look at excitations above that closed string vacuum. So the effective action that you get by making the substitutions that I described on the previous transparencies has a form that, of course, you don't know exactly, but we do know some things about the lowest derivative terms. So there's some prefactor out front, which comes from substituting in for the G string and rescaling the metric and all that. And then there are kinetic terms for the gauge field, and the gauge field always appears along with phi in this form. There's some function of the tachyon field that multiplies that, which we don't know exactly, and there are higher derivative terms. There's a kinetic energy term for the tachyon field multiplied by some function, and there's a potential term. Now, we do know a few things about this action, both from analysis using boundary conformal field theory and boundary string field theory, or background independent string field theory. We know that the function H vanishes in the closed string vacuum, and Sen's conjecture, which has also been backed up by various calculations in open string field theory and boundary string field theory, show that the value of the potential at zero is equal to one, which represents the fact that the difference between the open and or the D25 brain vacuum and the closed string vacuum is just the tension of the D25 brain in the way that I've scaled things. So we now have a non-commutative field theory. You should think of these fields here as being operators on Hilbert space. And we can act on the vacuum where phi is equal to 1, the closed string vacuum, and the gauge field is equal to 0, with a partial isometry to generate something that will represent an excitation above the vacuum. So what we find doing that is that we get a localized solution, and because I've chosen to turn on a B field in two dimensions, this solution is localized in the two non-commutative directions and is asymptotic to the closed string vacuum. So it represents some kind of a 23 brain because it's localized in two dimensions. And to find out what kind of a 23 brain it is, we can compute the energy. Computing the energy is rather straightforward using the solution generating ideas, because the covariant derivative of the tachyon field and covariant derivatives of the gauge field are zero in the vacuum. And since they transform covariantly, they'll be zero in this solution as well, since they started out being zero. And the kinetic term for the gauge field is not zero, but it's multiplied by this function which vanishes in the closed string vacuum. And if you work this out, it's proportional to a projection operator times 1 minus the projection operator. And therefore, in this 23 brain configuration, that contribution to the action also vanishes. And similarly, for higher order terms involving higher powers of the gauge field, but not higher derivative terms. So since all derivatives have to appear as covariant derivatives, and a covariant derivative of the tachyon field and the gauge field vanish, and since the terms involving the gauge field squared and higher powers all vanish, the only contribution to the energy, even though we don't know the form of all the higher derivative terms, the only term that can contribute is the potential term. And computing its contribution shows that the tension, or the energy per unit volume, of the 23 brain that we've constructed as a non-commutative soliton is n times the tension of a D23 brain, where n is the rank of the projection operator. So this is a strong argument that what we've managed to construct this way is, as we might have originally hoped, a lower dimensional D brain with a tension scaling like 1 over G string squared, G string being the open string coupling. Now, what I've presented is a generalization of an analysis that was done earlier in a paper with Krauss, Larson, and Martinek. And in that analysis, we did we studied the spectrum of fluctuations about these solutions, as well as looking at the tension, and found UN gauge fields and a tachyon in the adjoint representation of UN when we constructed a solution in terms of a Rankine projection operator, and that UN is embedded in the unitary group of transformations on Hilbert space. So this is a rather pretty picture. It gives a different way of thinking about where the non-abelian gauge symmetry on a D-brain comes from. In this non-commutative framework, it comes from a subgroup of unitary transformations on Hilbert space. Also, if we were trying to construct these as solitons not using non-commutative geometry, it would be very hard to see this non-abelian gauge symmetry by doing some kind of collective coordinate expansion. You can see abelian excitations that way, but it's very hard to see non-abelian excitations. But that comes out in a rather straightforward way that I haven't described, but generalizes
in a straightforward way what we did there. And you see that you do get this UN gauge symmetry coming out. It's also an improvement over earlier treatments in that we don't have to take a limit, as was done earlier, where the B field goes to infinity relative to the string scale. So this gives a description of D brains as solitons at finite values of the string coupling, at finite values of the non-commutivity parameter. And it's easily extended to other systems. For example, using the construction I showed you involving a complex scalar field, you can study DP brains as solitons of D anti-D systems or unstable D brains in 2B and 2A using various non-commutative generalizations of solitons that have been worked out, for example, in a paper that I wrote with Greg Moore. So all of the lower dimensional D brain systems, both BPS and non-BPS, in type 2 string theory can be constructed with exactly the right tension and exactly the right spectrum of low energy fluctuations as non-commutative solitons. So there are other approaches, of course, to trying to understand D brains as solitons, but in this approach you get rather powerful results that would be hard to obtain directly in, say, open string field theory. All right, so I have, I think, 5 minutes or maybe 4 minutes, which is probably not quite enough time to talk about the K-theory aspects. So I'll either go very fast or stop now. I don't know which. I guess I'll just go very fast. That's all right. K-theory is extremely simple, and I don't understand very much of it anyway. So the kind of fancy mathematics that physicists had to learn that was described by Kurt Callan when he talked about I forget which, whether it was the Baroque or the Rococo or which but roughly speaking, it involved learning something about algebraic topology, that is homotopy, homology, cohomology, which are how we compute the charges of solitons and instantons in field theory. And all those things are ways of taking some topological space and associating an abelian group to it, and the abelian group labeling the charges. Now, with the advent of D brains, we had to get a little fancier, and we had to say, well, not only do we have some space, but we've got a space with some vector bundles on it, representing the gauge fields on the D brains, and we had to figure out how to identify an abelian group, or how to associate an abelian group to this kind of structure, and that's one of the definitions of K-theory. So we now think that D brains have charges that live in K-theory because of that. Now, what I've been describing is yet another point of view of D brains. It says that they're non-commutative solitons, solitons in a non-commutative theory. So now what are we supposed to do? Well, we don't have, what's a non-commutative space? Well, it's essentially some kind of sub-algebra of the algebra of operators on Hilbert space, or we call it a C-star algebra. And we want some way of associating to that an abelian group. So mathematicians call this roughly the K-theory of C-star algebras. And I can give you a simple example of how this works. So one construction, which I didn't really go through, but is easy to understand from one of the examples in field theory that I gave you, is a construction of a D7 brain starting from a D9 anti-D9 brain in 2B theory. So this system has an unstable complex tachyon field phi, and if you use the solution generating technique, the solution that corresponds to a D7 brain is to have phi equal the shift operator. Or as a function on phase space, you have to take the Weyl transform of that. Now, in a commutative theory, the way that you would try to compute the charge if you had a complex tachyon field is you would compute the winding number of that complex scalar field around a circle at infinity, and that would be labeled by pi 1 of S1, and that integer would label the charge of the D7 brain. Now, here we don't have a circle at infinity. We have some non-commutative space, but we can find a way of figuring out how to generalize that in the following way. So what we want to identify the charge with here is, rather than the winding number, it's the index of the operator S. The index of a shift operator is minus 1.
And we can think about this by first of all generalizing the shift operator by thinking of our Hilbert space as being square integrable functions on the circle. Roughly, we should think of that circle as being some kind of circle at infinity. And if we have an orthonormal basis for our Hilbert space, and we take a function on the circle, which we can think of as an element of the CSAR algebra of functions on the circle, then it determines an operator on Hilbert space in an obvious way. We just multiply by the function. So I'm just being pedantic in the mathematical way by distinguishing the action from how it acts. So if the function is just e to the I theta, that just shifts this one up. But that operator has index 0 acting on this Hilbert space because the orthonormal basis for this Hilbert space has e to the I n theta n running over all integers. So that's not the same as the shift operator where we only had the positive or rather the non-negative integers. So to generalize that, we can define a subspace of the Hilbert space, H plus, which is the span of only the non-negative psi n's. And we can define P to be a projection operator onto that subspace. So if we do that, then we can generalize the shift operator by defining what's called a tuplets operator, which is an operator from H plus onto H plus, which consists of multiplying by a function, M sub f, that in general, if we start in H plus, moves us into all of H because we introduce some negative frequency modes, and then we ruthlessly project back. So this generalizes the shift operator in that you can check that the tuplets operator associated to the function e to the il theta is just the lth power of the shift operator. But now we can associate this shift operator not just to this function, but to any function on the circle. Now there's an index theorem for tuplets operators. The author of this goes by the wonderful name of Venugopal Krishna. And it relates the index of the tuplets operator to the winding number of f. So this is exactly the kind of relation that we are looking at, that we would like. Over here is what we would like to think of as being the classical winding number of this configuration. And on the left-hand side is the index of the operator associated to that function. So the index of the shift operator is how the D7 brain charge appears in the non-commutative theory. This winding number of a function, a circle around a circle at infinity, is how the charge appears in the commutative theory. And this index theorem relates these two points of view. Do I have minus minutes now, or
minus minutes?
Okay, I'll stop by saying that there is a nice extension of this, which takes a few more transparencies to go into, which is related to something called K-homology theory, which I know even less about. But it's related to a way of trying to study various extensions of C-star algebras, which was investigated by Brown, Douglas, and Fillmore. And it provides, the physics view of this provides a nice interpretation of some of the mathematical structure. You find that the things that mathematicians do to define this fits rather naturally into what we do in string theory, where we think about the asymptotic behavior of the fields and look at things modulo gauge equivalence, and it really maps on very nicely. But because of time, I will not go into that. So let me just end by listing three questions. First of all, I think we now have a pretty clear understanding of constructing D-brains as non-commutative solitons, which is one of the goals of that we like to study in studying tachyon condensation. But there are other hard problems. Of course, tachyon condensation in closed strings is hard. But a problem that's also very hard, even in studying tachyon condensation in open string theory, is to see the emergence of closed strings. And a number of people have looked at this, but I don't think anybody has a satisfactory understanding. It's not at all clear that non-commutative geometry will be useful in this, but perhaps it will be. It's also tempting to try to use this solution-generating idea anytime that we encounter an infinite dimensional symmetry group. And of course, cubic open string field theory has some kind of infinite dimensional symmetry group, although we don't know very much about what its global form is. It's natural to wonder whether there might be some way, starting from the vacuum, the closed string vacuum as represented, say, in level truncated string field theory, whether there's some way of acting with a non-unitary isometry and getting from that a D-brain configuration. Unfortunately, it's really hard to implement this with what we know, although there is an interesting recent paper by Rustelli, Sen, and Zwieback, which uses ideas somewhat related to this to try to construct D-brains based on a certain guess for what the closed-string vacuum is. And then finally, the mathematical formalism, which I just mentioned very briefly, shows that D-brains fit into a larger mathematical structure involving C-star algebras. Only certain C-star algebras have so far appeared, but it's possible that in trying to think about what the general description of D-brains is, that we will encounter more general objects. And if we do, there's a nice mathematical framework. What remains to be seen is whether there's a physical realization of what occurs rather naturally mathematically. So I'll stop there.
In your example of a 2 plus 1 dimensional theory, if the theory starts out to be Poincaré invariant, then you of course lose the Boost invariants. But if it starts out to be Galileo invariant, or if it's a topological theory, does it maintain any of the symmetries? Like if you had a Trent Simons theory, 2 plus 1 dimensional.
Yeah.
Trent Simons, well, coupled to some some Galilean invariant matter.
I haven't thought about it, and I'm not sure that I'm going to do a good job on my feet, so maybe we can talk about it. I haven't thought about that particular question.
Other questions for Jeff? Well, let's thank him again.